I just want to ask you about the silicon, and we'll go from there.
Let me just make sure that everything is working all right. Okay, I guess we can start watching if we have a problem now.
Ready? Mm-hmm. Today is 15 June, 1987. This is David Van Kuren and James Boney, and we are here for a second interview with Jerome and Isabella Carl on their career and their work. Now, the first question, I'd like to return us to where we left off the last interview. We were talking about the facility that the Met Lab in Chicago. What were they like? What were the facilities like in Chicago?
They were set up specifically for the purposes. Neither of us was there to be on the original construction, but these were annex-type buildings that were specifically set up for the purpose of carrying out the research. They seemed to be quite adequate.
Although temporary type.
Temporary mm-hmm. type construction, mm-hmm. but nevertheless quite adequate. Mm-hmm.
The sorts of things we were doing, one would say, is mostly physical chemistry. And there were no sophisticated instruments at that time for physical chemistry. We built our own vacuum lines. We had some technicians to help us. We used centrifuges, and we used, I had to build some high-temperature ovens, but I did that by myself. But that is what one would have done anyway in private research at a university laboratory.
We did our own glass blowing, for example.
The laboratories now are much different than they were in those days, in that there weren't very many instruments available commercially. And most of the specialized instruments the scientists either thought of themselves and designed themselves and built themselves, or looked at what his neighbor was doing, or a friend, and then copied them.
For intricate glass blowing, there was always such a facility with an expert around at university sites, and also there would also be a machine shop.
What were the safety facilities like?
Well, we handled extremely small amounts of material, and it was only really necessary to wear a mask over the nose so that you wouldn't breathe in naughty compounds that could do bad things in the system.
What was the attitude towards radiation at that time? The reason I ask is that, for example, uh-huh. the above ground test, we mm-hmm. marched troops in the ground zero an hour after the test. So I'm wondering in mm-hmm. the laboratory what the attitude was towards radiation.
They tried to be very careful, actually. We used to have blood tests every month. They had machines there for counting any radiation that might be circulating. It could do the hands and feet and so forth. And they tried to protect people from radiation damage. And there were certainly monitors around to tell when you had hot sources or not.
But we didn't have any special rooms, any special facilities for handling our materials. Each scientist sort of did it on his own. And for the most part, a lot of the precautions were taken because the materials demanded it. We had to have isolated boxes, isolated from air or isolated from moisture. so that the materials we worked with didn't decompose in the moisture of the air. And so I was introduced to dry boxes for the first time. It sort of looks like an incubator, and it has, they haven't changed much over the years. There are two long gloves that one puts his hands into. We used to use obstetrical gloves so that they fit well on the hands and we could handle the materials inside. And then there was a lock, and so the air was displaced with nitrogen. We could introduce samples through the separate lock where the air was pumped out, nitrogen pumped in, and it was dried in the usual ways. I think people still use that. And we made our own dry box. Now, I don't know whether it was something that a dry box originated there, that someone had thought of it, but at the time I arrived, one was being constructed for our small laboratory.
Last time we had talked somewhat about the work that you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't talk about mm-hmm. the work that Isabella was doing. Were you doing more synthetic work?
In a sense, yes. It was thought that if the halides of plutonium were made, then it would be easier to make the pure metal from the halides. So this would have been an intermediate step. And there were not more than a half a dozen, maybe only five people in our group. Norman Davidson was the group leader, and each one of us was assigned a different halide. And I was the first to make plutonium chloride, which forms absolutely gorgeous dark green crystals. The way that was made was to put some plutonium oxide, I don't remember which oxide it was yellow and greasy. And we got that from where? Oak Ridge?
Well, it was extracted from solutions that we had got.
But at any rate, when I saw it, it was already as a solid oxide, very small pieces, because I had to look through a microscope to pick up a few pieces of oxide to do my experiments with.
I think that it was BuO2.
I think so. I think it was a dioxide. I had never had any training whatsoever in any of my education in organic chemistry, and so I had to search through the library on how one makes chlorides from metal oxides. And there were a number of suggested compounds to use as starting materials for the chloride, and they all worked. The process was to put a bit of the oxide in a ceramic boat in a vacuum line, to put a furnace around the vacuum line. So the vacuum line in that place had to be made from silica glass, and I used to blow that myself with some intricate pads for the gas to pass over, a hot gas to pass over the hot oxide. And the various gases that I used, well, of course, not all of them were gases at room temperature, but they were at the high temperature, were carbon tetrachloride, chloroform, thionyl chloride. Oh, there must have been several others. Small organic compounds with chlorine in them that would vaporize to a gas and then break down in a high temperature to have the chlorine, and the chlorine reacted with the plutonium oxide. And again, I suppose I could look up my old reports, but after a few minutes at the very high temperature, I would let everything cool down, seal it off, put it in the dry box, open it up there, and I had beautiful green crystals, which again I would seal into a capillary to keep them isolated from air and moisture.
You were working in milligram amounts with that?
Yes, yes. I think they started out with micrograms. I think I eventually went up to a milligram or two, because only one or two crystals would grow, and they were
very tiny.
They were about the size as the point on a ballpoint pen.
Mm-hmm.
Other people in our group succeeded in making the bromide. The fluoride was difficult because that sort of went up. It was rather volatile. And that gave us a lot of concern because we didn't know where the plutonium went to. I don't remember if the iodide were made. I'm sure somebody must have been trying to make the iodide. Maybe Joe Katz worked closely with me physically, although we worked on different materials. He may have possibly worked on iodide.
I noticed from Seaborg's report that in C1 you had very frequent meetings with the different techniques, got together and discussed their research. What was the feeling like, both at C1 and the Met Lab, and the whole sense of community spirit? Was people interacting an awful lot? How would you characterize?
Oh, I think that the morale was good, and that people were generally quite friendly. But several people from that time whom we were still in contact with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think as far as working in the laboratory, nobody was secretive. We shared suggestions, ideas, and told other people what they were doing. And I think that helped a good deal in developing something that was, you know, completely unknown. And at the same time, I think a lot of instrumentation and procedures were developed that were unknown at the time.
Was there any aspect of your work at the Met Lab that you thought was particularly helpful to you in your later research? Anything that sticks out in your mind?
Well, I don't know about that. I think what really sticks out in my mind is just the creativity that had to go on to handle unknown problems. I mean, the way we approached our problems. Can I talk to Richard for a moment? Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you about the administrative structure of this. Was this conducive to the work that was going on? Was it well organized?
Well, in my view, scientific laboratories that are well organized are not conducive to doing good work. Organizing things is what you do when you don't know what else to do. Good science goes on when there are talented free spirits. And there was, of course, some kind of an organization, but the things that were accomplished were, for the most part, accomplished by people who were free spirits. There was no real attempt to do anything more than to exchange ideas and achieve agreements and directions. So far as Isabella and I were concerned, we both had an immediate group leader. Norman Davidson was hers. The name of the gentleman in mine escapes me for the moment. And then at the head of all of it was Glenn Seaborg. The paths to be taken were just broadly agreed to, then you went ahead and did your work. And so I would say that the laboratory was ideally organized for accomplishing creative things, because the laboratory was not overly organized.
Was that typical of Seaboard? Was that his doing? Did he understand that?
I would think so. Nobody ever verbalized on this, but certainly the lab was run the way he would have liked it to be.
Can you tell me more about him at that time? Did you met with, you were in those meetings with him?
Yes. Well, he was very talented, bright, energetic gentleman who knew his subject thoroughly. The impression that always came off. He was the leader and the major participant in the discussions. And he gave always very favorable and very impressive impressions.
In addition to Seaborg, I don't know if you had mentioned this, we also had meetings at which Fermi spoke every once in a while, and then people who had come from the other laboratories, Oak Ridge or Los Alamos, would also speak about the work going on and the progress being made, the problems in the other laboratories.
Yes, those were not in any way informal conversations, because there were questions at the end, but these meetings filled the auditorium and physics building, and they were just general lectures.
So you had a good knowledge of what was going on in the Manhattan Project as a whole, as a turn to the other lab?
To a certain extent. There was a need for informational security, and so there were legitimate limitations that were put on how much detailed information was widespread, but we had a general knowledge of what was going on in various places.
I think the one exception, at least in my mind, was that I never really knew what was going on at Columbia.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't even remember anybody coming from Columbia. That may be an error, but I don't remember anyone from Columbia.
I don't recall any real exchanges with the people of Columbia. Mm-hmm.
That would have been Harold Urey and...
Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, one knows now better from the accounts of the entire project what he was doing. But at the time, they were quite secretive.
I wanted to ask you about Norman Davis.
Yes.
As a group leader.
Well, he's fine.
We knew him earlier, actually, because he spent a year postdoctoral with our research professor. And so, in fact, shared an office with him. Yeah, he's a nice gentleman. They say that the place was loosely organized, and so there were not deep interactions scientifically. Isabella knew what she wanted to try to synthesize and how to go about it, and that's what she did.
The organization was such that, perhaps once a month or so, we would write a very informal report as to what had happened during the months. And as I said, I was quite fortunate in making the chloride in a number of different ways, at least in the crude way in which I had made it, all of them seemed to be quite equivalent.
Was that a successful route then to plutonium?
Oh, yes. A successful route for making the plutonium
right,
eventually.
From the chloride.
We do not know what the ultimate method was that was used to make the pump.
That was done, your chloride went elsewhere then, from Chicago.
We don't know ultimately what method was used. I could guess, but I there's no point.
Eventually, the various plutonium materials that were synthesized, well, I shouldn't say eventually at the same time, but there were too many of them to be done all at once. I used to take my chloride samples to Professor Zachariasen, who was doing the X-ray diffraction. He was he already head of the physics department? Or no.
No, Compton was there.
Well, he eventually was head of the physics department, but he was a professor at that
time.
And
then he became dean of science, but that was much after the war.
And he was one of the very early X-ray diffractionists from the time he was a student. And so at that time he was characterizing the new materials that were brought to him. And there were, of course, too many for him to have completed without computers and all that sort of thing not being available in those days. And he worked on them for quite a number of years afterwards and published the various structures. It was a somewhat amusing incident to me in that I used to seal up these materials and carry over a crystal or two to him across campus. And after a while, when security found out about it, they said, oh, I couldn't possibly do that all by myself. I had two guys walking on either side of me to deliver
them. And everybody who knew there was something going on in Chicago could tell perfectly well that Isabella was carrying hot stuff. A little girl with pigtails, I don't think, would have attracted that kind of attention anyway. So we always thought that that was a self-defeating operation.
Who insisted on that?
We had a security group around the laboratory, around our building certainly, because it was one of the temporary buildings put up devoted to plutonium chemistry.
We had to wear badges.
Yes, and there were guards at the door. They must have somehow or other found out that I was carrying these samples over. I don't really know how it came about.
You left the Met Lab in July of 1994 to return to Ann Arbor. Can you give us some background on this departure? Did you have a job offer in Ann Arbor, or why did you leave the Met Lab at this particular time?
Yes, well, in some sense, we had each completed the projects to the extent that we could there. And Lawrence Brockway had a project going on with the Navy that seemed quite interesting to us. It was still war work, so we didn't have any conscience problems about going from one place to the other.
It was a kind of a stopping point, and we would have had to go on to different sorts of projects at University of Chicago, since both he had and I had accomplished what we had set out to do.
In a lot of respects, the activities were slowing down a bit there because they had fulfilled a number of the interests that they had. And so it just seemed to us at the time that it would be just as well if we went on. And then there was the opportunity to do things that were a little bit closer to specific training.
Mm-hmm. Had Brockway contacted you about this project? Did you know before you went to the Met Lab that he was doing it?
Yeah, we were always good friends. He'd come out to see us in Chicago and all that sort of thing. We remained good friends. Was to socialize quite a bit. It continued very much after we got back there. And it was not unusual to have a knock on our door at midnight, and there would be Lawrence Brockway outside the door. How'd you like to go swimming in the Huron River? So the thing was so contaminated that we would never dare put our heads in, but we'd drive out a while and go to a place where it wasn't flowing too fast and it wasn't over our heads and get in there for a while. There were always crazy larks like that. And, the way things were spontaneous and so forth, but we enjoyed each other's company very much. Mm-hmm. Remained friends, good friends until he died.
At that time, I also got an offer to be on the faculty at the University of Michigan, which was most unusual. I think I was the first woman to be on a faculty. I had the grade of instructor, and I was teaching the elementary chemistry classes.
That was a real step up for Isabella, and it stood her in good stead for the future.
I don't know if we cover that ground at the Met Lab, but as a woman at the Met Lab, did you feel comfortable with your interactions with your colleagues? Were there other women there?
If there were, there weren't many. I can't think of any.
Women scientists. There
no.
probably were some, but certainly not close
not
to
close.
Us.
Not close.
No.
There were women, of course, who were secretaries, who were technicians, who did quite a number of things in the laboratory. No, there was no problem in being a woman there.
There weren't many women scientists in the Those trained, PhD trained, very few. But colleagues were extremely friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Was Brockway instrumental in getting you the faculty appointment?
I don't know. I don't know about that. Most of the universities at that time were teaching mostly the 16 and 17-year-old boys, because by 18 they were all being drafted, and girls. A good many of the younger faculty had to be involved in defense-related projects, and there was a shortage of faculty, and so I was available. They knew about me. Who actually was instrumental in hiring me, I don't remember.
Who was chairman of the department then?
That was a man by the name of Shepley.
S-C-H-O-E-P-F-L-E.
I would never have spelled that one.
His background was organic chemistry, dyes, things of that sort. Something that was not at all common. I mean, we had no common ground. That's interesting. Mm.
Yeah, he was a student of the very famous organic chemist at the University of Michigan by the name of Moses Gomberg.
Yeah. Free radical chemist.
Yes.
That's right.
That's right.